consumers of interoperability brought together with the people who do it for a living. And so today is a little bit the condensed meta day, with most of the talks being on condensed meta. And so Paul Fedley is a wonderful speaker for this. He's actually never given a talk in our series. And he is a great expert in conformal field theory and integrable models, and really integrable two-dimensional quantum field theory, but with a certain focus on condensed meta problems. So let's look forward to his talk, which is called Edge Modes, Zero Modes, and Conserved Charges in Parafermionic Chains.
Thanks, Matthias. Thanks. It's nice to be invited here, talk to a different crowd of people than I usually hang out with. Maybe I was part of this crowd 20 years ago, but maybe not so much anymore. But yeah, when I was trying to make the title for this, I was not sure of how to make a title that would dazzle all of you, so I just kind of gave up and gave it the title. I was going to give the paper anyway, so sorry about that, but I assure you that I will have a lot to say about the I part of the title, and actually even something to say about the G part of the title, even though that's not obvious. The S, maybe not, but that's for you to tell me after I give the talk. In fact, there's a puzzle for you all to tell me something. Okay, so when I first made this talk, the first time I gave this talk, it was for Eduardo Fradkin's 60th birthday, and you know, for these sorts of things, you put sort of, I don't know, fun stuff at the beginning, and you know, now this is a different kind of thing, so I was about to delete all this stuff, but then actually I read this again, what I put down there, and actually I thought it was really appropriate for this conference, so I left the fun stuff in here. And this is a quote from an old paper, I'll show you which in a second, but I think it's something to just remind yourself. This paper was written in 1981, but I think it's still very true today, and in particular, that was the first sentence of a paper, and then it went on, these are the next sentences. It's talking about how stuff that happens in StatMech, the field I live in, illuminates some stuff in particle physics, and in particular, one of the main things in my life, and actually in a lot of people's life in condensed matter physics these days, is to understand what happens in systems with fractional charge, and because those can be realized experimentally. And, well, there's a whole long story, that's why I have something to do with Microsoft. So that's related to what I'm going to talk about today. Today I'll focus on some of the more formal aspects. I just wanted to call attention to one thing. The authors of this paper did not notice which way they said for statistical physics and field theory, which they said was up and which they said was back. So I think that's probably an audience-dependent decision on whether you go up to field theory or up to statistical physics. I'll let you decide that. Anyway, the paper that begins with these quotes is a brilliant old and probably neglected, not completely ignored, but neglected paper by Fradkin and Kadanoff about 30 years ago. And what they did, they introduced to physics the idea of parafermions. At least as far as I know, this was the first place that they were mentioned. And so you may have heard of parafermions in a variety of places. For the StatMech types, there's a few of you here. They're actually a really elegant way of describing ZN integrable lattice models, and that I'll explain in detail. And one example most of you probably heard of is the three-state POTS model is an example of such. This crowd may have heard of more is the critical points of these particular integrable lattice models are described by a particular conformal field theory, which is also called the parafermion conformal field theory. And it's, for those of you who know about Wessamina-Witten models, the non-abelian part, the kind of interesting, non-trivial part of the Wessamina-Witten models is given by these parafermion theories. You just throw out a boson. There's this algebraic structure called W algebras. Sergei Lukyanov worked on that for his thesis. And the next speaker. So again, this is for those of you who know a little bit about the quantum Hall effect, but the parafermion conformal field theory is used as an essential way to create what are called the Reed-Rosselli wave functions, and those are cool because Those things have something to do with topological order. So this isn't, I debated on whether I should tell you about topological order and all that. That's a really great story. And I decided to just confine it basically to this one slide. So what topological order is, there's a lot of definitions. And if you want, ask me, and I'll give you one of them. I'm going to give you a not very good but useful definition later on. But anyway, what the reason why we're interested in systems with topological order is that typically they have excitations with odd properties. So they can be anionic, which means in a two-dimensional system, they're neither bosonic nor fermionic. They pick up, say, a phase. Or even more interestingly, the thing I mentioned down here, they have non-abelian braiding, which says when you take a particle around another particle, the state of the system actually changes. You have a vacuum, or I should say you have a manifold of states, of multi-particle states, so that when you take them around, it doesn't change the energy, but it does move you around in this Hilbert space. And so that's what people call anionic. Fractionalized is another word that means almost the same thing. In a more CFT context, you might call these spin charge separated. There's a bunch of ways of saying it, but all these are at least roughly and often exactly the same physics. It means that the excitations have funny properties, or I should say funny, not our usual bosonic fermionic properties. And the intimate relation between these physics and 2D conformal field theory goes much deeper than just some models occur in both contexts. In fact, when you try and understand the rules that anions have to obey, they must obey exactly what are the rules that Moore and Seiberg came up with to describe 2D rational conformal field theory. So it's an extremely intricate mesh of stuff. Now, the neglected thing here, maybe I guess I should have put another line in here for this audience. Actually, integrability, concepts that came up in integrability, in particular the Temperley-Leib algebra, actually predated all of this stuff. In fact, the first example of all these ideas all came in integral theories. So all the mathematical structure is essentially identical in all of them. And I'll say a little bit more about that later on. And since this is a field theory crowd, an example of a theory that has these marvelous properties that most of you know is Chern-Simons field theory. So now I have to rationalize my existence. So I think we all revert, to some extent, to what we did as a graduate student. And I spent a lot of time doing lattice models, so I like lattice models. And this crowd is not really a lattice model crowd. But again, for example, Jimbo's talk this morning, he starts out by doing lattice models. And in many contexts in integrability, it's much easier to deal with a system that's on the lattice than it is with the field theory. That's not always true. What? Yeah, exactly. No, right. So sometimes you have them both. Sometimes you have them, you know, it's a question of taste. But at least it's important. The only point is not the continuum is bad. Ultimately, we want to do the continuum, but often it's good to start on the lattice. And in particular, I mentioned this old paper by Fradkin and Kadanoff where they introduce parafermions. And so what the idea is now, so I mentioned a few things about parafermions. I mentioned a few things about topological order and a few things about integrability. And I'm going to describe now how to put a lot of these things together. And one reason this is of interest to the condensed matter crowd is this is progress. This is a problem I haven't solved, but I'll say something about it at the end. This is a ZN invariant generalization, but an interacting generalization, what's called the Kataev-Honeycomb model. And if you don't know what that is, I will tell you later on. Okay. So the outline is first I'm going to do some what seems to be really baby physics, but which a lot of people at this moment in time in the condensed matter world are very interested in. It's what I would call the icing model, but what they call now the Meyer on a chain, and I'll explain why that is. And it's actually a good name, and I'll explain why that is. And then I'm going to explain how some of these beautiful ideas that have been pushed about recently, how they apply in the three-state chiral Potts model, but then even without trying, we end up with some really interesting results for integrable models. So just motivated by the physics of what's going on here, we end up with some new stuff in integrability. At least I think it's new. And then at the end, whatever time I have left, I'll tell you how to make a 2+1-dimensional model. I mentioned this Kataev-Honeycomb model. That's actually a model in 2+1 dimensions, which is where we want to have anions and do that whole story. Okay, so this is the Ising model. This is baby, but it's not. I mean, it's profound. The Ising model is just such a rich and beautiful model. People say, yeah, it's just free fermions. But there's so much interesting physics in the Ising model, and it's not just free fermions. Okay, so this is, I'm going to do everything in the quantum Hamiltonian language. I guess I'm a condensed matter physicist now. That's the way we like to do things. And for this context, it's definitely the easiest way to do it. So instead of writing down just the usual nearest neighbor interaction, I write down a quantum Hamiltonian. And so what this says is I have a Hamiltonian, and there's two terms. This, the condensed matter people often call transverse field. But what it does is, if you think about it, just flip the spin, and this one makes a nearest neighbor interaction. And it's not hard to check using duality that the critical point of the model occurs when the two couplings are the same. And so thus, when this coupling J is greater than the coupling F in front of the Philip term, you get an ordered phase because this term, which wants to line them up, I probably should have put a minus sign there, I guess. Anti-aligns them the way I wrote it. And a symmetry operator that's sort of interesting is to notice if you just flip all the spins, that commutes with this Hamiltonian. That's the Z2 symmetry that makes it an Ising model. Okay, so again, ancient stuff, but really important, is to how to fermionize this model and, quote, solve this model. It's a way of computing the partition function or the free energy exactly. It doesn't solve all the correlators or even close, but it does give you the free energy exactly. And so I won't belabor what this is. It's just the spin flip and then, sorry, well, I wrote it in a little bit of a funny basis, but this is a string of these spin flips. And then you act on one site with just sigma z, and then you have the string there. I wrote it in a sort of x and z opposite basis to make the Hamiltonian look nicer. And that's a string of this spin flip symmetry. And so probably most people have seen this. If you want, I can belabor it more. But you just write down these operators. The miracle is that they anti-commute. Okay. Well, that's miracle number one, is that they anti-commute. And again, now this spin flip symmetry that I wrote down before in terms of the spin variables actually becomes pretty nice. Well, it looks complicated, but it's actually just minus one of the F. So one thing I guess I should note, I wrote these out in terms of Majorana fermions. Usually when people write that out, they'll write them in terms of Dirac fermions. So these Majorana fermions just square to one. So that it's Majorana. It's equivalent to what people usually do. So let me draw some pictures. I'm now with Hamiltonians. I'm going to write down a few Hamiltonians, but I'm going to illustrate them all pictorially. So that was the most complicated slide, I think, in the talk, the previous one. But so what? So now this is just exactly a picture of what I wrote down before. So if you remember, so there's the Hamiltonian. There's a flip term that acts just on the sites. And then there's the nearest neighbor interaction. Then I fermionized. So notice I did Majorana fermion. So I have two fermions on every site, which I called psi and chi. And so now this is how I draw them. So I draw my two fermions as these little red and yellow dots. Blue and yellow dots. So the blue, I guess, is the psi, and the yellow is the chi. And then I drew these lines here to represent these couplings. So this little red hat here means basically the spin flip term, the coupling, the spin flip at every site. When you write down now that Hamiltonian in terms of fermions, you just get this bilinear. And then the nearest neighbor interaction, I labeled by the purple sort of line there, and when you fermionize that, you still get a bilinear. So that's the second miracle. First, you can define these fermions nicely, and then second, the Hamiltonian becomes a bilinear in the fermions. And with periodic boundary conditions, it looks exactly the same, except I have one that glues that one down. Well, not the transformation. It's the spectrum of the transfer matrix of the classical model and a particular anisotropic limit. So the classical model, if you allow anisotropic couplings, is a little bit richer, but all the physics is contained in this. There's a particular Jx over J1 limit gives you this. There's a catch if you worry about boundary conditions. You have to twist them, which, if you care, ask me later. Okay, so let's do the physics of this now. So I said the physics before, but I just want to say it again because it's important and I want to draw the pictures. So in the limit that J equals zero, if you look, so J was the coupling that was the nearest neighbor sigma Z coupling, which translates in the fermionic language to coupling a psi fermion on this site to the chi myron on that site. And so all, oh, sorry, that's the other way. Oh, that was the J coupling. So if we set J equals zero, then there's no coupling there, and all we have is the spin flip term. So that's all there. And so all that, you can obviously solve this system in a second. You just diagonalize sigma x on each site. Everything commutes. The other extreme limit is f equals 0, which is ordered in spin language. So you have only the sigma z pieces. There's no spin flip. So again, you can solve this in a second. But Kataev made the following trivial and profound observation. You know, profound observations are often such precisely because you can explain them in 1 second to everybody and they all go, duh. And this is one of those, but it's profound. He says, well, notice these limits actually do have one pretty distinct property right here. Here's one limit and here's there. By duality, they're related, but duality doesn't respect boundary conditions. He says, if you take this limit, notice there's guys on the ends that don't do anything. They're not part of the Hamiltonian anymore. Whereas here, all the fermions are there. So those are edge modes. And in fact, the Fermi, you just check, since they don't appear in the Hamiltonian, and fermions anti-commute, and everything is bilinear, so these extra dangling fermions commute with the Hamiltonian. They give a symmetry. But what's more so I mentioned before I was going to give you a definition of topological order. This is actually a pretty bad definition of topological order, but operationally it's kind of a useful one. It says that if you have a system that has gapless edge modes, you've got topological order. There's other ones which are at least mostly equivalent or completely equivalent. And that's really interesting for the people who study this sort of stuff because gapless edge modes are associated with fractionalized excitations and all that. Again, it's not a one-to-one thing, but systems that have gapless edge modes often have these funny anionic excitations that I mentioned before. And here it's easy to see. It's almost trivial. I mean, you just take these operators. You have two ground states, easy to check, in this extreme limit where we turn off the spin flip term. And in more particle physics language, this would be called an exact zero mode. Now, it's not instantly obvious, but it's not a lot of work since the Ising model is integrable. It's very integrable because you can write things in terms of free fermions. But you can check that this sort of topological order that you still have gapless edge modes persists as long as you stay with the spin if you wish, the order phase in the spin language. Then Kataev explained you didn't have to just take this nearest neighbor interaction that I did. You can take an arbitrary interaction. And it still persists as long as you stay in the ordered phase, ordered in the spin language. And so, okay, that seemed a little fluke of boundary conditions, and I'm trying to do something pretty deep here. I'm trying to explain phases. Then, you know, you can ask, well, what happens with periodic boundary conditions? That shouldn't change the physics. Obviously, it'll get rid of the gapless edge modes. But it doesn't change the physics. That's why I think gapless edge modes maybe aren't a good definition, because, of course, sometimes we want to look at systems with periodic boundary conditions. And so, again, so Kataev explained how to do this. The simplest way is actually, if you look at this fermion parity of the ground state, that's a way of doing it. That's not obvious. A much fancier way is to compute the sign of the Pfaffian of the matrix that appears in the Hamiltonian, the thing that's multiplying the fermion by linears. And for people who know something about topology, this is basically the churn number reduced by one dimension. But here's the way I wanted to explain in detail. It's heuristic, but it's the one that we're going to be able to generalize to the Zn case. So it says, well, what do we mean by zero mode? So it says, now, what we want to do is we have a Hamiltonian, and we want something that commutes with the Hamiltonian. That's the zero mode. I'm going to actually do something a little bit more general. This looks ugly, but OK, just look at this. This is just the Hamiltonian, and this is just what turns out to be just basically, if you took a Dirac fermion, this would be like psi dagger. And maybe there's a sign there, maybe it's not. But it's easy to check. This is just trivial commuting fermions. But what happens when I commute this with that, I just get a shift in this. And so this is more than a zero mode. It's actually a shift mode, depending on what the values of the coupling are. So if we're at the critical point, so that's F equals plus or minus J, then you can make this thing zero, and then it just commutes you to exact zero mode. Away from the zero point, notice this thing is exactly the same as this thing, and so it just shifts the energy. So it just shifts the whole spectrum. But it acts on the whole spectrum. So it says that, so that's what a zero mode is. It just says you take a state, and I add the zero mode, and I have another state with the same energy. Well, this one says add this, quote, zero mode, and I just shift the energy. But it's the same shift for every state. So it just shifts the whole spectrum. And like I just said, it's an exact degeneracy there. All right, so that's the Ising model. I hope most of that was at least slightly familiar to you all. I'm basically going to do now the three-state model, but in the exact same fashion. I'm going to just, what I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to do the algebra, but the algebra is almost entirely straightforward. So now again, so most of you probably have heard of the three-state POTS model. It's just a system that has three states at every site instead of two states like the Ising model. So if I do the three-state classical POTS model, I have three states and I demand a symmetry between an S3 symmetry just like the Ising model has a Z2 symmetry. So basically there's only one interaction. Are the two neighboring spins the same or are they different? And that's what the POTS model is. This is now the quantum Hamiltonian. So if I do a 2D classical model, it's equivalent to a 1D quantum model. And this is the classical version. And it looks exactly like the Ising model, except now I have three states. And so this is the flip term. It just either increases it by one, or in this case, decreases it by one. Now we have two different things one can do as opposed to the Ising model. So this is like sigma x. And then this thing is basically like the sigma z term. It just either aligns or anti-aligns spins. But now, instead, of course, I have three states, so I have to do that. And these matrices, just like the Pauli matrices square to one, these matrices cube to one, and they don't anti-commute. They give you this phase omega. That's a lot different because now you have to pay attention. Does the tau come first or the sigma come first? When fermions anti-commute, you don't have to make any. So you define parafermions just like fermions now. There's a string, and then you have an operator site, so psi at j. And these are like Majorana parafermions. I define two at every site, just like I define fermions in the Ising model. I have this string, and then I have the operator. Now the distinction is I have a psi dagger, and these parafermions cube to one, and then you can check that psi squared is psi dagger. So there's more. If you wish, there's psi dagger, chi dagger at every site. And again, instead of anti-commutators, you get this funny phase when you bring one through another. But in many ways, it's like the Ising model. But this fact that it's a phase actually, it makes them interacting because now it matters which side you're on. So you, even though the Hamiltonian, which there I guess I start to write down there, even though the Hamiltonian is bilinear in parafermions, you can't just solve it in a second like you do for the Ising model. In the Ising model, you solve that Hamiltonian just by Fourier transforming. You can Fourier transform here, of course, but the catch is because the sign depends on, if you go back and look at these things here, the anti-commutation relation depends on whether it's to the left or the right. And so thus, when you Fourier transform, things don't turn into a bilinear in momentum space, and you can't just solve the model in a second. Another way of saying it in field theory is these things don't obey Wick's theorem. So here's the Hamiltonian now that I wrote down before in terms of the spin degrees of freedom. You rewrite that, and again, this is exactly the same picture I cut and pasted from the Ising case. But now we have this bilinear and parafermions on each side, and another bilinear parafermions on each side. And like I say, it's not solvable. In fact, if you look at that model I just wrote down, the three-state POTS model is not solvable except at the critical point. The field theory is solvable off the critical point, but the lattice model isn't. And so they're not free fermions. It's not integrable except at the critical point. The lattice model, the field theory is. But the nice thing about this argument I gave you for the edge modes before, the reason I gave this heuristic argument when there exist exact arguments is here, I can make the heuristic argument. I just draw the same picture. Again, I cut and paste the same picture from the fermion case. So in other words, if I set this coupling, the one at each site, which is that bilinear to zero, so that was the flip term in the Z3 case, well, I have these guys at the end. So I have gapless edge modes in that limit. So because it's not solvable, I can't prove that the gapless edge modes persist for the whole phase, but I think it's pretty likely, and for reasons I'm about to tell you. Okay, so again, so now let's look at the periodic boundary condition case. So what happens there is, so what I showed before for the Ising model, just an exercise in anti-commutators, that there's some operator that I called the fermion zero mode operator, and when I commute it with H, I get just the zero mode operator back. And like I said, it's not quite a zero mode, it shifts it, but it's essentially the same as the zero mode. And again, I write it out as just some linear combination of all of those. And so now, again, it's an exercise, and I don't know what you call phase commutation, you know, keeping track of your omega, this e to the 2 pi over 3, but you go through the exercise, and you find the answer is yes, but only if these coupling constants obey a really interesting constraint. And this is where integrability is going to come in. So I'm going to take a slightly more general model than the one I wrote down. Now, because it's Z3, I actually have an added degree of freedom. So this was my fermion bilinear, and that was the other fermion bilinear, because I have daggers now. I can put a phase here. Still a Hermitian Hamiltonian. In Ising model, that's pointless. But here, it's definitely not pointless. And so I do the same there, and I can make arbitrary phase. And then you go back, just do this computation. You ask, well, I make psi, I let alpha and beta be arbitrary. Can I find an alpha and a beta such that this is true? Well, I can find it for a given alpha and beta if these couplings F and J obey that condition. Okay, so that's algebra, you know, hours worth of algebra. And then it's an exact zero mode. And that's, again, strong evidence that, well, it essentially proves that for these couplings, you have these exact zero modes. And then strong evidence that even if I don't obey this condition, it remains true. So so what I talked about before was just theta equals zero and phi equals zero. So that, again, was only the critical point, which is the integrable point. Without this guy. One thing to notice, this actually is now called the Chiral-Potts model. So the word chiral, because actually we've broken parity symmetry and think time reversal too. Yeah, right. Okay, yes, that's what I say. Yes, so now the Chiral-Potts model. Okay, so this is the thing. So what I just did was actually the world's absolute easiest way of finding what describes the integrable Chiral-Potts model. So the Chiral-Potts model in general would be just general F, J, theta, and phi. So it's three couplings. You have an overall thing you can scale out. So it's three couplings, and we put one condition on them. And then it turns out it's integrable. And in fact, this property of the exact zero mode was observed a long time ago. In fact, the sort of, well, I don't know, it's amusing. I don't know who. Howes, I guess, was a graduate student, and he wrote this paper doing these incredibly difficult computations in perturbation theory to see that this exact degeneracy existed. And obviously he didn't read, notice he wrote a paper with Kadnoff, he didn't read the paper his, I guess, advisor had written a year before with Fradkin, because if he had, he could have done the computation I'm done and saved himself, a year or two's worth of work. But so it goes, von Gehlen, other people then have said. So the Chiral-Potts model, yeah, you can't really read the green. So von Gehlen, Rittenberg, Albertini, McCoy, and Perk, and maybe someone else, Baxter. And actually, what I did with the parafermions is almost certainly related to something Bajanov and Stroganov did with the, which was called the Tau 2 model. So all I did was demand that condition, and I got that free. It doesn't prove it's integrable, but these guys already long ago doing much more difficult computations proved it's integrable. So going with this whole sort of deal, we want to see now what we can get. So now this is now the integrable part of the talk. So I'll divert from trying to explain to you what the interest is for topological stuff, and now maybe try and explain a little what this might say interesting about integrable. So a special case that had been noted by all these people where things are very special. So notice if I put theta equals pi over 6 and phi equals pi over 6, right? So a cosine, that becomes zero, and so actually any F and J work. And that's sort of the most physical case. If you check with theta and phi equal pi over 6 before, it's exactly halfway between ferromagnet and antiferromagnet. So that means the spectrum is invariant under E goes to minus E, to be precise. But that satisfies for any F and J. And so we can get all the way to this limit of J equals 0 and still have it be integrable. So the integral Kiro-Potts model is really peculiar. Baxter, a bunch of people, but in particular Baxter spent 20 years, more than 20 years now, studying this model. He has this marvelous formula for the magnetization in this model. It's one of the peculiarities. It's people here, we had a talk on theta functions. So Boltzmann weights in integrable models, most of you probably know, are usually satisfied by elliptic theta functions. These are satisfied by functions take values on higher genus surfaces. Again, everyone here, or almost everyone here, probably knows what the Yang-Baxter equation is, but it does solve sort of a Yang-Baxter equation, but it doesn't have the difference property, the theta 1 minus theta 2 that you see in essentially every case but this one. So there's a bunch of stuff. There's more stuff too. It's really cool, and in some ways it has a lot in common with free fermions, which is why it's so intriguing. And in particular, the thing that makes it look very satisfying, and I will explain this, is you can relate it to something called the Onsager algebra. And the Onsager algebra is really peculiar because it's actually related to how Onsager solved the Ising model. Very few people probably have read that paper. Actually, I haven't either. So the free fermion thing I showed you to solve the Ising model, to compute the free energy of the Ising model, came by Kaufman about 5 years after Onsager. She came up with that. And Onsager had another way, which involved much more intricate stuff. But what it boiled down to was showing that what in this language I would say was that the various elements of the Hamiltonian obeyed an interesting algebra and used that to find that and a lot of intuition. And a more modern version of this is due to Dolan and Grady, and von Gehlen-Rittenberg pointed out that this applied to the Kiro-Potts model. I can't remember. I think Dolan and Grady really didn't have a non-trivial example of this algebra other than the Ising model already. It was von Gehlen-Rittenberg and then Davis who came up with it. So a result that I think is new, so this is the exercise for the audience, I'm going to show you a way of rewriting the Onsager algebra, which is not the way you'll see in these papers. And you're either going to tell me this is widely known. I don't think it's known in the Kiro-Potts literature, but maybe the algebra I write down is known somewhere else, so I would love if someone would tell me. So maybe this is known, but it was certainly unknown to me, and I've never seen it anywhere else. So let me rewrite this algebra. So in this case, it just literally means these couplings. And they called it superintegrable because this algebra I'm about to display was there. It seemed special to them, so they called it super. Well, I think it does. So ask me that again after I show you the algebra, because I think it does. I don't know of anywhere else this has appeared. No, but they didn't know. At least as far as I know, they it looked cool, it looked very special, so they named it super, because super is super. Nothing to do with supersymmetry, although I'll get to that in a sec. Okay, so this is just a little bit technical, but I wanted to be honest. Okay, to make this work out right, instead of working in the basis where I had tau as the flip and sigma as the diagonal one, you just change basis, like going from a sigma x diagonal to sigma z diagonal basis, and you write sigma this way. But instead now, notice this sort of takes, if I label this plus, zero, minus, notice these two guys are like s plus, and then that guy is like s minus squared. Right? Okay. That's all. I'm saying nothing sophisticated here. I'm just writing these two guys as the usual s plus for spin one, and this is S minus squared, because it goes from plus all the way down to minus. That's all I'm doing. So now I plug that into the Hamiltonian I wrote down before. So I do a little bit of algebra. I just say, now I group all the pieces that conserve the U1 symmetry into this bit. I group all the pieces that violate it by plus 3. So that will be terms where there's S plus on one side and S plus squared on the other. They've got that e to the I pi over 6, because I've got that phase. I'll call that B plus, and likewise the S minus I S minus I plus 1 squared, I group into there. So this page is just trivial algebra, nothing sophisticated. So here's the cool part, though. So, okay, so I call this B0, B plus, and B minus. The 0 plus and minus were for obvious reasons. The subscript 1 is for, well, on this page, very non-obvious reasons, but on the next page, we'll see why. Okay, so now the rest of the Hamiltonian I call B0, because this is the diagonal piece now. I've diagonalized tau, so this is diagonal. I call that B0, 0. These other things I just set to 0. Okay, so now what the Onsager algebra, to define the algebra, I do this. So I just take the commutator, I just build them up. So I've given you the B0s on the bottom with a plus and minus and 0 on top, and I've given you the 1, and then I just have now a recursion relation that lets me define all the Bn's via this one or this one. So this is just defining the higher, the 0, and the reason the superscript sort of tells you how they're violating the U1 symmetry, whether they violate by plus 3. So that's an algebra. Well, so that's not an algebra. That's just a definition. Now, the stunningly remarkable thing, and why they called it super integral, because this is actually kind of super, is now you can play games with these generators, and you find that now all of these generators so defined, so I defined a whole infinite set of generators here, now they all close. The algebra closes at this point. Moreover, they close in a really elegant fashion. So the plus, minus, and zeros just behave like they're SU2s. I forgot to write down what is the most important one of the three. Sorry. There's a third one which says that any time you've got a plus with bm plus, with bn plus, they commute, or b0m with b0n. Let me write it down because it's just... It defeats the whole purpose if I forget to say this one. So any... plus or minus. So those just commute with each other. So, well, I don't know. Okay, so this is sort of work I did within the last month. This was the question for the audience. Anyone seen this before? It's such a simple algebra. Well, see, the difference between, notice it's n plus n and n minus n. The usual Kac-Moody algebras will just have an n plus m, right? So that's, it's not, so I think it's, that would violate Kac-Moody-osity, I think. You know, someone raising their hand? Yeah. So you can get this as a quotient. Has someone done this? I mean, well, okay, I'll ask you later to tell me where this has been seen, because I hadn't seen this before. With this algebra, so it's really remarkable. You make this singly infinite set of generator, well, three, zeros and plus and minus one series, and then you get nothing else. You commute them all, and the way it behaves is just this remarkably simple thing. It's stunningly beautiful. I mean, it was pretty beautiful in the original formulation. I think this is even more beautiful. And so then my Hamiltonian I wrote was of this form before. Remember, I just made the generators by taking various bits of the Hamiltonian. This is actually a little bit more general than the Hamiltonian I wrote down before. The Hamiltonian I wrote down before has beta equals gamma. So again, something, at least as far as I can tell, wasn't noted in the literature. This is actually solvable for any value of alpha, beta, and gamma. There's one parameter deformation of the Chiral-Potts model that's integrable. And by saying it's integrable, I know it's integrable because by using this algebra, I construct the, it's easy now to construct the things that commute with the Hamiltonian. So this again is, this goes much easier than most integrable models, even though there's this weirdness with it, not the Yang-Baxter not obeying the integral properties. And since yesterday we heard a little bit about hidden supersymmetry, I wanted to mentioned something that's very much still work in progress. So I haven't gotten around to doing with the Baedon-Sots the general case. I want to recover what the other people did, but I did the gamma equals zero. So this one is U1 symmetric. And actually the beta equations are those of the XXE chain. There's one caveat which you can ask me about later, but there are those of the XXE chain at a very special point. And the special point is my favorite point on the XXE chain. It's what people usually call delta equals a half or delta equals minus a half. There's a whole story related to what's called the Razumov-Stroganov conjecture, which in my version is where the XXE model has a hidden supersymmetry. And this, why I wanted to mention this to this audience is because this is something that is true, but for which we don't have a deep explanation. So you take the XXE at this special point. It's in the field theory language, it's a free boson at its supersymmetric radius, the C equals 1, 2D conformal field theory at the radius where it's a super, also a superconformal field theory. E to the I pi over 3. So it's, oh yeah, the question is what's the Q of SU2Q? Yeah, for this audience, some of this. So it's Q equals E to the I pi over 3, which is sort of the next simplest point after free fermions. It's not free fermions, but it's where the field theory is that of a superconformal field theory. But moreover, on the lattice, you can explicitly show that there's a hidden supersymmetry in the XXE model. So this was shown for XXE by a paper I wrote with Carl Jan Chautens and Bernard Nienhaus a while ago. And then we have a new paper with my postdoc, Christian Hagendorf, talking about how this works along a line in the XYZ chain. So this is very curious. But the beta equations are exactly the same. So almost certainly there's some weird hidden supersymmetry, at least when gamma equals 0 in the Chiral-Potts model. I don't have any statements yet to make about gamma not equals 0. But there, that was the last slide on the 1D stuff. So one other comment, again, in the Chiral-Potts model, known stuff is, if you set beta equals gamma and look at the spectrum obeys a free fermion like property. You can put the spectrum into sort of 2x2 matrices, and that's again one of the magical things about the Chiral-Potts model along this super integrable line. So that was all. So I have about 5 minutes left? 10 or 5? Okay. All right. So that was all I was going to say about the 1D case. I wanted to say a little bit about the 2D case since that's what motivated a lot of the work. So I'll go through that very quickly. And then questions you want to ask me, please ask about the 1D case again. So I set all this up so I could very easily define what's called the Kataev-Honeycomb model. So I'll go through this quickly, but I hopefully not do. So the Kataev-Honeycomb model is just a spin model. I'll write it down in a second. A very easy nearest neighbor spin model, write down Hamiltonian, is very simple and elegant, but which Kataev showed could be mapped onto free fermions coupled to background gauge field. So that's why we get the G part of the IGST. And I'll explain that can all be generalized to the parafermion. It's very much an open problem how to analyze the model right down, but at least the model itself can be generalized, and I'll explain that quickly. All right, so let me do the Kataev-Honeycomb model very quickly. So this is the quantum YZ chain. So instead of the icing chain, I'm going to do something a little more complicated, and it's usually called the XY chain, but to conform with my earlier notations, I have to call it the YZ chain. So it just has nearest neighbor couplings that are either sigma Z or sigma Y. I can vary the couplings if I want. And when you fermionize this exactly like I did before, again, it's just bilinears. But notice one thing. Notice that the JZ one only does these fermions. And then the JY only does these fermions. And so now, there I fermionized it. Those were the couplings. And so that's what they are in fermion language. That's a good animation. So actually, it's easy to see. Now, I just take this Hamiltonian. I can split it into two pieces, and these pieces commute with each other. This must have been known to Schultz, Madison, Lieb 50 years ago, but it must have been known. I've never seen anyone really point this out. So this is, the world's easiest way of seeing that the XY chain turns into two icing models. You literally just separate the two Hamiltonians. You fermionize and separate the two Hamiltonians. But now the trick in the Kataev-Honeycomb model is this. You take one of those two Hamiltonians. So this is a Hamiltonian alternating with Zs and Ys. So notice it's Z, 2J minus 1, and Z, 2J. But then the Ys are 2J, 2J plus 1. So notice how I drew it. And then you fermionize it like that. But see, notice with these pictures, you see these guys don't even appear in the Hamiltonian, just like the edge modes I showed at the very beginning. They don't appear. And moreover, each one of these fermions commutes with the whole Hamiltonian. So it's like a whole, it's not just edge modes, they're everywhere. It's the same deal. And so then what Kataev said was, okay, take a bunch of these chains, these funny YZ chains, and now just couple them into a honeycomb lattice. So here it is in fermionic language. That one means a psi and a chi. This one means a chi and a psi. And now I do a bilinear. Do that. And that's, we'll do that everywhere. And that's sigma x, sigma x. So this is the Kataev honeycomb model. It's really simple. It's got sigma x along here. It's got sigma y there. And it's got sigma z there. And you have to think a little, notice that's a honeycomb or hexagonal lattice. Okay, and that's the Kataev honeycomb model, and that's the fermion. Now, this isn't bilinear in terms of fermions. There's four fermions there. But what Kataev pointed out then is there's fermion bilinears that commute with the Hamiltonian. So I'll go quick because that's just an exercise in anti-commuting. And so those commute, and thus you see it's actually a Z2 gauge flux because there's one of these bilinears for every thing. And then if you write it back in terms of the sigmas. So what this model is just Z free fermions coupled to a background gauge flux, the gauge flux you just fix at the beginning, and there it goes. And then, so the part I'll definitely skip is then you can show that if you break time reversal invariance by adding a magnetic field, you get non-abelian anionic excitations. Okay, so power fermions, now since I'm out of time, I'll just show the pictures. You can do the exact same thing. So you write out these power fermion bilinears like I did, and then I couple them before. Now, even the power fermion chain itself isn't solvable except at this critical point. So certainly once you couple them, it's not solvable. But it is power fermions coupled to a background gauge field. So you can get the background gauge field. There's the gauge flux in terms of the original variable. So that's a model. It's sort of incomplete. I should mention Zhaoling Shi came up with, without knowing anything about power fermions, just thinking about Zn and Kataev, came up with a almost the same model. But since the models aren't solvable yet, at least at this point, I guess we have to have some numerics. However, the stuff I told you about the Onsager algebra was my attempt. So before I go on to 2D, I'm back into 1D. And I'm hoping that this exact results in 1D will be useful when putting together these models in 2D. In particular, there's something I should note. There's these very bizarre tuples fundamental integral models. I don't think they've ever come up in the IGST world. They satisfy this equation called the tetrahedral equation. And so correct me if they have come up. But did it? Bajanov was here. Okay, good. So Bajanov, yeah, I was going to say he's the world's leading authority probably these days on those models. Yeah, so, but one thing to note is, so Kataev gave you a solvable model, Hamiltonian tuples one dimensions. Even though it's a spin Hamiltonian, he showed to map it onto free fermions with this background gauge field. We have these other bizarre models sometimes called the Baxter-Bajanov models, and they satisfy this thing called the tetrahedral equation that Zamolodchikov came up with. But if you take those known integrable models from 2 plus 1 dimensions and just chop them and look at what they are in 2 dimensions, they actually are the Karl-Potts models. So this to me is a strong hint that if I think about it hard enough, or if one of you thinks about it hard enough, they'll be able to come up with a way to rewrite some of these solvable models or some variation on those solvable models in the fashion I'm doing. I guess all the other questions I put at the end are pretty self-evident. Can you generalize this Pfaffian Chern number to fermions? So is there an analog of the Pfaffian for Zn is a fascinating question. It's also, that's a question one can ask for statistical mechanics. The quantum computing people I hang out with might care about the first question. Again, this question of whether this is up or back. I mean, if I can do some math and come up with a generalization of the Chern number, is that the partition function of some interesting stat-mech model? I haven't done for Zn, but that should all work. But can I take n to infinity and get a U1? And the question I'm will spend the last month of this Onsager algebra, it's just really intriguing. So anyway, thanks for listening.
Questions? I didn't.
As far as this Chern number goes, is there a non-one for the fractional quantum Hall effect? I don't think so, right?
No, not that I know of. I mean, yeah. That's a problem. There's a whole huge industry now with that people call topological insulators and all that. And people, there are things known about the fractional quantum Hall effect, but there's, so in the integer quantum Hall effect and generalizations, there's this whole classification that actually also due to Kataev using K theory, so something string theorists know something about. And so there's this beautiful classification there, and people have added interactions to those to sort of see what happens under deformation. The results I know of are mainly then just one-dimensional, not any dimension. And also, these things really aren't perturbations of free fermions. This is kind of starting completely separately. Kataev's got some unpublished work using group cohomology that probably would apply at least to the 1D case. And so that's, well, once I get all the 1D stuff settled, hopefully it'll. So there's probably, so the answer is, at least 1D, there's almost certainly there exists a structure that'll apply to this. And then 2D, well, we'll see.
Are you saying that the super integrable is somehow some structure that's really beyond Young-Baxter and there's some further algebraic structure? Which,
yeah, absolutely. Put that up just so you guys can gaze on that again. Because, yeah, I really would like feedback if anybody's seen anything like this before. Where'd it go? There we go. It is definitely beyond Young-Baxter. Because like I say, it's definitely beyond Young-Baxter. Because like I say, these models don't even satisfy the usual Young-Baxter equation. And as far as I know, it only comes up in these models.
No, that's not true. We have it in ADS50. The Shastri matrix of the Howard model also has no difference property.
Oh, they don't obey the... Okay. Yeah. All right, good. All right, so... All right, so that's does it have an algebra akin to this?
And it's also related to the tetrahedron equation somehow.
Okay, good. Well, all right. Then they must be somehow cousins. Okay, good. So someone later, please explain to me. Shastri's not here, but someone.
Further questions? So then, thank you again. All right.